Hello, and welcome to Power Pros Podcast, episode 144. I am your host, The Hoff, Chris Hoffman, and with me is my co-host and nemesis, Pete Michaud.
Now you're playing with power.
That's right, Pete. We are especially playing with power this week because our big topic for this week's episode is going to be the 30th anniversary of Nintendo Power Magazine.
That's right, a whole stinking 30 years.
Yeah, obviously we would not be here if it were not for Nintendo Power. So yeah, it's already been 3 decades, so that is going to be the focus of this week's show, a retrospective on our favorite gone but not forgotten video game magazine.
Wait, does that mean Nintendo Power is your dad, if you wouldn't be here if it wasn't for them?
No.
Just checking.
However, before we get to that, we have a lot of other things to discuss in the world of Nintendo. We have some new games to talk about, we've got some news to discuss, and I think we're going to kick things off by talking about a new release that came out just a couple of days ago, Mega Man X Legacy Collection 1 and 2.
Ooh. You've been playing this, Chris?
Oh, yes. I mean, the game just came out yesterday as we record this, so I haven't had a ton of time to spend with these games, but I did play all the way through Mega Man X1 already, and I have tried out all of the other 7 games that are included across these 2 collections.
Holy smokes, what do you think?
Well, obviously I'm a big Mega Man fan, going all the way back, and so Mega Man X Legacy Collection 1, in particular, is chock full of side-scrolling action platforming goodness. To me, Mega Man X1 is still one of the best action games out there, and still the best game in the Mega Man X series. I mean, compared to, you know, the previous Mega Man games, it adds new mechanics like the dash and the wall jump, as well as exploration elements to find, you know, hidden life ups and E-tanks and armor parts.
Yep.
But it doesn't go overkill with all of the extra stuff you need to hunt down. Like, that formula obviously worked really well for them in that game. So with Mega Man X2 and X3, it was like, well, let's do basically the same thing, but have even more stuff to hunt down. You know, we'll hunt down these parts for the robotic walker, and we'll hunt down these Zero parts and things like that.
Right.
And to me, that made them a little bit overcomplicated, but they're still an awful lot of fun.
Yep.
And then Mega Man X4 took the series 32-bit. It made Zero a true standalone playable character, and it had some really high production values for its time with these really sharp graphics and full anime cutscenes, even though the English voiceovers are kind of junk.
Amazing.
So yeah, that game is really, really fun. All 4 games are pretty excellent, pun intended.
No.
In addition to the games themselves, it has an extensive gallery mode that has art and music and photos of collectibles. Plus, there's a variety of graphical filters and wallpaper options. There's even a rookie mode you can select that makes all the games easier, although I haven't used that yet, so I'm not exactly sure how it works.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the Day of Sigma anime is in there.
Oh, wow.
It's not super high res or anything, but it looks pretty darn good on the big screen, and it's cool to finally have that on console for the first time. Strangely, there are no save states, and there's no rewind function like you might expect for a retro collection like this, but it still has lots and lots of good extra content. Of course, last but not least, one of those new bonuses is the X Challenge mode, where you fight 2 bosses at once. You get to select which weapons you bring into battle, and then take on a series of adversaries where you are, yes, fighting 2 of the Mavericks at the same time.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it is pretty nuts. I haven't played a whole lot of it, but it seems pretty cool so far, and obviously, you know, can provide quite a challenge.
I can't even think of another game that's ever even tried that.
Yeah, me neither, now that I think about it. Of course, in addition to the first collection, there is Mega Man X Legacy Collection 2, and it is just not nearly as good. Mega Man X5 is, you know, pretty decent, but clearly it was done with, like, no budget. And then X6 is just, you know, not very good. It's full of odd level design and cheap gameplay choices and the like. And then with Mega Man X7, it takes the series 3D, and it does not do it very successfully.
Hmm.
Mega Man X8 goes back to, you know, traditional 2D gameplay, and I remember when that game first came out, I'm like, oh, well, this is pretty darn good compared to X7, but when you're playing it in the same collection with the traditional 2D Mega Man X games, you know, it really seems like a step backward. I mean, it's better than X6 for sure, and, you know, maybe not quite as good as X5, but if you've already been playing X1, 2, 3, and 4, and then you play X8, you're like, yeah, this isn't nearly as good.
Right.
I mean, it's really not bad, but it's not as good as I first thought it was, you know.
Sure.
Simply because I've got so many better Mega Man X games to play all of a sudden, so.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, odd choice for them to split it up like that, but who knows?
Yeah, I mean, I would expect that Legacy Collection 1 will sell much, much better than Legacy Collection 2. Legacy Collection 2 does have pretty much all the same bells and whistles of the first collection. The X Challenge mode is very similar, but does feature some different battles. And, of course, it has, you know, different artwork and music for the games that are included there.
Hmm.
But really, Legacy Collection 2 is only for the hardcore Mega Man fanatics. Everyone else should probably just get Mega Man X Legacy Collection 1, stick to that, and if they fall totally in love with it, then like, okay, maybe I'll see what comes next. I really need more of this, even if it's not quite as good. But yeah, obviously, for me, a huge Mega Man fan, I am very happy just to have these on the Switch at all.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Can I ask, what format did you pick these up in?
I got the physical edition, which is Mega Man Legacy Collection 1 on a cartridge, and then you have to download Mega Man Legacy Collection 2.
Hmm. And I wonder, like, the bonus that you get, is that on the game itself, or is that something that comes with the physical release?
Oh, the anime, you mean? That content is on the cartridge. Yeah, so it's there, included. It's a download. If you get the digital version, it's there on the cartridge if you get the cartridge
version. Gotcha. Okay, I was wondering how you get that if you bought the digital version.
Yep, it's all there.
Cool. All right. Well, considering getting the first one, so we'll see.
Well, it is pretty darn great, so I would say certainly check it out.
Now, I've heard Mega Man Soccer was locked in there somehow, like as an Easter egg. Have you figured out how to unlock it yet?
I am pretty confident that is a load of BS.
You better try the Mega Man Amiibo on Stage 4.
Sorry to disappoint you. Well, speaking of classic 16-bit series that have gotten new life on Nintendo systems recently, I've also been playing the update to Sonic Mania, Sonic Mania Plus, with the Encore DLC.
Oh yeah, you promised me you were going to play that. Are you playing it?
I am indeed. You know, we wanted to have this one on last week's episode, but Amazon messed up my delivery.
Oh, that's right.
And so we didn't get it until after we had done the recording.
And thoughts?
Well, as you know, I loved the original Sonic Mania, and I believe you did too, right?
Yeah, of course. What's not to love?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really fantastic update to the Sonic formula. It really feels like, you know, classic Sonic, or maybe even better than classic Sonic. It's like our memories of classic Sonic. And what this DLC does is it adds two new playable characters, Ray the Flying Squirrel and Mighty the Armadillo.
Huh.
And so if you play in Mania mode, which was the original, you know, level-to-level mode in the previous game, you can now play as these new characters and use their new abilities. Ray can glide a lot like Mario in Super Mario World, where you have to move back and forth to gain air and add lift and sustain your glide. It's a little tricky to do at first, but, you know, you practice and you can really, really fly around a stage once you get the hang of it, which I haven't quite done yet. And then Mighty has a ground pound for smashing open secret passages, and he can also defend against projectiles when he curls up into a ball.
Kind of like me.
Yes, exactly. It's just like your beard. Then there's the new Encore mode, which enables you to switch between characters with a press of the button. So you get to play through a remixed version of the game. Like, the Green Hill Zone has a new color palette and has some newly accessible areas, like some new places that are underwater. And then there are new passages and things to take advantage of the new character's abilities. Like, you can see some spots on the ground that are clearly made to smash through using Mighty's ground pound.
Mm.
There's also a brand new intro level set on Angel Island from Sonic 3, but it's very, very short. But, you know, this lets you play as all five characters in a remixed version of the game, and it's a really good excuse to replay a game that you might have already played through.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's very nice. Then there's also a four-player versus mode, but I have not had a chance to try that out yet.
Hmm. All right, you have my interest piqued.
Yeah, and it's only $4.99 to buy this as DLC if you want to just add it on to your existing digital purchase of Sonic Mania. For me, however, I had to go and get the physical release because I really wanted a physical edition of Sonic Mania when it first came out practically a year ago. And so we finally got that. It includes the DLC, so you can get the whole thing for $30. And in addition to the game itself, it comes with a 20-page art book. And another thing that's really cool is a reversible cover that actually mimics a Genesis box.
Oh, sweet.
So for like an old school Sega fan like me, it's a pretty neat inclusion.
Yeah, I like that.
But either way, it's really, really hard to go wrong with this game. It was great. It was one of my favorites from last year. And now I would say it is indeed even better.
Now, I'm assuming the DLC doesn't like mess with your regular game. You can still play the regular portion.
Right, right. Like I said, there is still Mania Mode, which is the same one from last year. And if you select that, you can still pick up where your previous saves left off, or you can start a new save using the new characters, and then Encore Mode is separate from that. So yes, your save file transfers over flawlessly. There's no problems whatsoever.
Well, for $5, I don't see why you wouldn't pick it up.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, even spending $30, I don't regret it one bit. So yeah, it is definitely great stuff. And Pete, knowing that you're such a fan, you know, I would say absolutely go and get it right away.
All right. Will do.
Now, of course, you haven't been playing Mega Man. You haven't been playing Sonic. What have you been playing on Switch?
Well, my interest was piqued during one of the indie showcases, and I can't remember which one now, but there was a game that kind of tickled my fancy, and that would be Pool Panic.
Oh, yes. That one looked very, very interesting. That is a bizarre and strange and wacky take on pool. It's kind of the golf story of pool games, it seemed.
Yeah, although I would say that that's about as far as that comparison goes, just the sense that it's a game based on pool and Golf Story is a game based on golf.
Yeah, I really don't know that much else about other than that it's crazy and wacky and zany and not like real pool at all. But I have been very curious about it, so please fill me in. Tell me what this game is all about. Have you been enjoying it? I want to hear it all.
All right. So, yes, I have been enjoying it. At its most basic level, it is a pool game.
Right.
In which you basically jump around to these different boards. There's an overworld. You go right from a tutorial right to an overworld, and then you start just jumping into random games of pool.
Okay.
Now, these games of pool take place kind of everywhere. Some might be on a campground. Some might be on like a floating pool table in the universe someplace.
Okay.
Part of the charm of the game is that all these pool tables kind of just take place at random.
Right.
Although it's not totally random. They are based on the way the world is laid out, but you still wouldn't really be able to guess what the pool table is going to look like by what the level looks like in the overworld map.
Okay.
So then as your character warps into this level, you're literally standing on a pool table.
And what is your character? Is your character like an actual, you know, pool cue or a pool ball or something like
yes,
that?
Yes, so your character is a pool ball. In fact, everybody in the game is a pool ball.
Uh-huh.
And they all have different styles. There's certain ones that do different things. There's some that are like little monsters that'll like chase you. There's some that shake the ground and will move all the pool balls on the table. At its core, it's basically a puzzle game.
Huh.
There's almost no real RPG elements that I'm seeing at all. I don't know why I was thinking it might be. I think it's because of the golf story concept. But okay. But it is fun. I mean, you go through and each level rates you on different things. You don't actually know what your rating is. You just have four categories you're trying to excel in.
Okay.
And essentially, it just shows you when you haven't met that requirement. So one is the time of the level to beat. One is the amount of shots. And then also, did you scratch?
Okay.
So really, you go around this overworld map, jumping into just random games of pool. You really have no idea what to expect. But some of the fun and the charm of the game is that it is so like random. There's certain levels where you have to do certain things, like on a campground, you have to like hit a grill until burgers fall down. And then when the burgers fall down, more pool balls run out to eat the burgers.
Bizarre.
Yeah, it's really bizarre. I mean, if you've seen the art style at all, you'll kind of get the concept.
Right, which I have. So.
Yeah. So once you complete these pool levels, it doesn't matter really what the requirements you met were, just as long as you cleared the level, it counts that as one. And there's this thing in the center of the level that has, it's like a countdown timer, and it starts at like 105. And so I'm assuming, basically, as you beat each level, you can kind of run back to this tower, and it will count the number down. And in doing so, the level will actually like rise up like a tower.
Huh.
And I'm assuming that once you get down to zero, something special happens. I think there's even little mid-level bonuses you get. I still haven't unlocked one yet, but there are certain things that appear on the tower as the level kind of stretches out. It's really hard to explain that, but it's basically like a giant cinnamon roll just being unraveled from the middle.
Well, I love giant cinnamon rolls, so that sounds good to me.
You know, I will say I'm a little bit bummed out that there's not more to it. That being said, it does feel like one of those kind of fun, like, pick-up-and-play when you're bored games that you really can just kind of jump in. Doesn't matter what you have done. You just kind of, like, enter a new level and try to complete it.
So is there anything more to the actual gameplay than just following traditional pool rules? Like, we know that, you know, the levels are wacky, but as far as, you know, the gameplay and the physics and things like that, are you just sort of, you know, playing like a traditional game of pool just in these, you know, really bizarre, silly environments?
Yeah, I mean, pretty accurately, the game is exactly what you just described. I'd say the only thing that really changes is that you have the ability to select which type of shot it is, like a heavy shot or a weak shot.
Okay.
And then basically just the types of balls that you encounter and how you get through the level. There definitely are some that you can only beat in certain manners. There's a especially kind of fun mini game where you kind of like walk into this random bar on the map and you challenge these three different guys who are sitting at a bar drinking juice, it looks like.
Mm-hmm. Juice.
And you jump into a mini pool table behind them and challenge each one.
Mm-hmm.
And each one is like kind of like a weird, you only get one shot, you can't move. So it's like kind of a puzzle in and of itself.
Okay.
But again, there's very set parameters. You don't really have a lot of options, but it's weirdly compelling. So I don't know what to tell you. If you like puzzles and you like pool and you like cult classic type games, I can imagine them being sort of into this game. I am weirdly drawn to it because you just kind of want to see what else is in there.
Yeah, for sure.
But that being said, you know, I think for $15, it is okay value. I don't know how long it'll last me, but, you know, sometimes you're just looking for a game that's pick up and play and you don't have to think too much about.
Okay, that sounds fair enough. So you're pretty happy with the purchase so far then?
Yeah, it's not so bad. But I would advise anyone who's thinking about picking it up to maybe watch a couple videos and read a couple reviews. It's not the full-fledged game that Golf Story is. You know, right on the main page of the eShop, it says the world's least realistic pool simulator. And I have to...
that sounds about
I
right.
I have to agree with that. This is the best way to convey what this game is. And I recommend you do your homework before you pick it up.
Okay. I admit, I am very curious. I'm not really much of a billiards game player, but it sounds just zany enough for me to try. But, you know, I'll probably wait until after I, you know, finally sit down and play Golf Story first.
Yes, play Golf Story first. That's my recommendation.
Okay, good to know. All right, well, moving along then from new releases to a game that is not quite out yet. It will be out in a little more than a week, and that is WarioWare Gold for Nintendo 3DS. There is a demo that's out now in the eShop. Pete, have you had a chance to check this out yet?
You know, honestly, Chris, I kind of forgot this game was coming out until you just mentioned it.
Well, Pete, do you like WarioWare? Do you like micro games? Do you like mashing buttons and touching your touchscreen and tilting your 3DS?
Yes.
Well, in that case, you will probably like WarioWare Gold. The thing about this game is that it has 300 micro games in it. Some of them are brand new. Some of them are rehashed from previous WarioWare games. But as always, you know, they're very quick events and there is tons and tons of variety. There's one game that's as simple as, you know, mashing the A button to run really fast. There's another one where you rotate your 3DS to, like, determine the placement of a fence and keep this animal penned in. There's another one where you tilt it to keep a surfer balance on top of a wave. There's one where you enter, you know, quick button commands to perform actions and cast spells in an RPG. There's one where you know, tilt the 3DS back and forth to quickly move this guy's arm to grab food and stuff it in his mouth. There's another one where you're sliding the Joy-Cons onto a Switch with that, you know, really satisfying, you know, clicking sound effect that the Switch is known for. Another one has you just, you know, rubbing the touchscreen really fast to unroll toilet paper. And there's even a game where you make a guy poop. Like, he puts the food in his mouth, you have to tilt it through his body and down his throat and right out his butt.
Wow.
It's almost as gross as I make it sound.
I don't believe you.
It's true. It's true. So, you know, it's everything you would really expect from WarioWare. It's fast. It's zany. It's got lots of variety. You know, there's only so much you can do in this demo, but they promise the full game will have segments called That's Life, where it's, you know, these real life-ish situations, I guess, like unrolling toilet paper.
Okay.
It'll have fantasy, and then it'll have gaming stuff. You know, none of the 9-volt games are in this demo, but obviously, you know, that's a beloved character, and there'll be lots of NES references in the final game.
That's my favorite part.
Yeah, I think it's probably mine too, probably a lot of people's.
Yeah.
And then the final game's also going to have something called Wario's Amiibo Sketch.
Whoa. And what's that about?
I don't really know what it's about. They say you can only scan 3 Amiibo per day. Mm. But if it's compatible with, like, every Amiibo, that'll still take me, like, well over a month to do.
And are you going to start an Excel chart that I can view?
I probably should. I probably really, really should.
You probably should.
Indeed, indeed. But yeah, the game comes out on August 3rd, and I am definitely going to pick it up based on this demo. There hasn't been a WarioWare game in quite a long time. I don't know why it's taken them so long to do a proper WarioWare title on 3DS, you know, or any other recent system for that matter. We didn't even get one on Wii U, which is just craziness.
Yeah.
But yeah, it, you know, I was totally hooked, totally addicted. Even though I know this is just a demo, I found myself, you know, replaying the levels again and again. Like, okay, I got to get a high score. It doesn't matter. I'm probably never going to play the demo again after that one time. But it's like, oh no, getting, you know, 35 isn't enough. I have to keep going. Got to keep playing. Got to keep playing. So, yeah, even though 3DS is kind of on its last legs, I am totally looking forward to this game.
Cool. Yeah. If I was still playing my 3DS, I would be all over this.
Well, the demo is out there for you. It's totally free to try out, so I say check it out, and maybe you'll get hooked as well.
All right.
Let us move along from there and talk about just a little bit of news. So there's not a whole lot of news I wanted to discuss this week, but I did think it was pertinent to mention that Nintendo has announced a release date for some upcoming Amiibo.
Amiibo!
Hmm.
Yes, the Octoling 3-pack will be out on December 7th. That is a date that will live in Splatoon infamy.
Have you already ordered them?
Oh, yes. I pre-ordered it as soon as it was available. Now I know when I can expect it to show up on my doorstep. Yeah.
How many places did you pre-order it from?
2, probably.
Amazing.
I think I pre-ordered it from Best Buy and from Amazon. Although it is with good reason. I don't know if I'm actually going to, you know, still be living in the same place come December, so if I have to have it, you know, delivered, then Amazon's the way to go. But if I'm still here, I can cancel that order. I can go pick it up at the local Best Buy. So I do have a good excuse for doing that.
Your cardboard box is finally getting dismantled?
That's right. You know, come December, the rains might carry it away.
I kid the hobo.
Kind of. But in addition to that, we also had San Diego Comic-Con just recently. And there were some interesting bits of news from one of my favorite properties. You know, we were talking about lots of Mega Man X goodness earlier,
mm-hmm.
and the details have been revealed on the upcoming Mega Man cartoon. That is Mega Man Fully Charged.
Oh. Well, tell me about it.
Well, it is debuting August 5th at 6:30 a.m. on the Cartoon Network. That is not terribly far off. And I don't know if you've seen any of the footage or images from this series that have been revealed over the last several months, but it is a brand new take on Mega Man. It uses all new designs. It's not quite the Mega Man we remember. And it's kind of looking okay, I would say. You know, it's certainly not old school classic Mega Man or any other Mega Man I know. This Mega Man is very lanky, and man, Dr. Light is like super burly. You know, he's not really, I mean, he's always been a little bit on the chunky side, but he's like just kind of a huge dude in this.
Yeah.
And then there's this new character called Mega Mini, who is this miniature robot who like lives in Mega Man's head.
Hmm.
And I guess he causes some of Mega Man's functions to run properly. And he seems like he might be very annoying. We'll see how that goes. I did like the design of the Robot Masters they showed. Fireman was featured prominently in the clip that was revealed.
Mm-hmm.
And the music takes a lot of cues from the game, so I like that a lot as well. And there were interjections of sprite art for the transition between scenes, which was pretty cool.
Hmm. Cool.
The animation, on the other hand, didn't really seem that great, and I'm kind of worried that this Mega Man is going to be kind of like Spider-Man, where he's like doing all this wisecracking comedy while he's fighting. And
yeah.
I have kind of concerns that that's going to fall flat and get annoying real quickly. But overall, it was better than I was expecting, and I am very much open to anything that puts Mega Man in the spotlight, and I'll be sure to watch the real thing when it hits in the very near future.
Yeah, it looks worth the viewing, for sure.
Right, absolutely.
Now, I have to ask, do you have a Hoff Mini that runs around inside your brain doing things?
I've never seen him, but I'm pretty sure I do, yes. Whereas you have a Pete Mini who just lives in your beard.
I can't argue with it.
But speaking of animated versions of our favorite games, you know, this one isn't exactly new, but have you had a chance to check out Sonic Mania Adventures?
You know, I did see a trailer for it. What's the story with that?
Well, are you sure it was a trailer? Because this thing is actually really, really short. You know, they've been releasing these 3-minute episodes over the last few months. There are only 5 episodes, 3 minutes each, but it is totally worth checking out. It's got some great animation with music and sound straight out of the games, and it's kind of simple and silly and dumb, and there's no dialogue, so it's, in that sense, you know, kind of like an old silent cartoon. But it's really endearing, it's really true to the characters, and, you know, pretty much all the characters from Mania show up here. So Sonic, Tails, Knuckles, Ray, Mighty, Metal Sonic, and Dr. Robotnik are all in there. I found it to be really, really fun and charming and worthwhile. And if you like Sonic, if you like Sonic Mania, totally check it out. It's on YouTube. It's free. Like I said, you can watch the whole thing in like under 15 minutes. So it is highly recommended to all Sonic fans.
I'm actually looking at it now. I did watch one of these and I think I did think it was a trailer. But it is great. I mean, I love the art style. I love the, it's kind of reminds me of like, you know, like you said, old cartoons where it just the point isn't necessarily the dialogue. It's more about the actions of the characters and
right.
kind of the hijinks. So it's great.
Right, right. But it's not like, you know, overly goofy, overly slapstick. So yeah, it's just really, really charming and it's a lot of fun. And it's done in a very similar style to the opening cinematic of Sonic Mania. I just kind of wish it was actually included on there. If that were included in the game as a bonus, that would be, you know, perfect. But yeah, even just as a YouTube video, it's pretty awesome.
Yeah, it is.
And the last bit of video game related cartoon news is about Castlevania.
Oh.
Now, of course, we know that Castlevania Season 2 is coming in October. But recently, on the official Castlevania Cartoon Twitter account, they mentioned that there is probably going to be some sort of home video release for the Castlevania series.
Mm.
They didn't provide any details, but it sounds to me like it will be released on, you know, DVD and or Blu-ray sometime in the future. And, you know, if you like that show like we do, no, that's probably worth looking forward to.
Yeah, that's a fantastic series, and it's cool that there's a way to officially buy it.
Yeah, absolutely. That takes care of our news for this week, so I think it's time for us to take an intermission, and then we come back, we'll discuss this week's big topic, which is the 30th anniversary of Nintendo Power. All right, we are back, and we are ready to discuss this week's big topic, which is the 30th anniversary of Nintendo Power Magazine. As I said earlier, Nintendo Power Magazine is the reason that we are both here. We are both veterans of the magazine, and they were a big part of our lives as gamers. They were a big part of our careers, and, you know, it was a very significant publication for a lot of Nintendo fans as well.
Yeah, it's true. Nintendo Power was kind of a staple of my childhood.
Yeah, and even though the magazine closed its doors almost 6 years ago, it is still loved by people around the world. There are other magazines that pay homage to it. There is this podcast, of course, that's carrying on that tradition. And, of course, Nintendo Power recently came back in its own podcast form.
Yeah, but we won't talk about that.
However, it all started 30 years ago with the print publication, the July-August issue of Nintendo Power number 1. And so, in celebration of this momentous occasion, we are going to take a trip down memory lane here to talk about the evolution and highlights of Nintendo Power magazine over the publication's lifespan.
Cool. I hope we can do it justice.
Yes, me too. Obviously, it started as a bi-monthly publication with a very heavy focus on strategy. There were lots of maps and features consisted of, you know, these big 2D game maps with lots of call-outs, and at least 10% of the time, the articles didn't even make sense. It would just have words and phrases. Like, one of them that really stood out to me was for Blaster Master, where it says, "One sip of plutonium and these mutants go wild."
Yeah, I could see that.
But despite, you know, the silliness and craziness and things like that, the thing that I always loved about the magazine is how it was this gateway into these new and unexplored worlds. And by having such a visually focused publication with all these maps and strategies, you know, it really lived up to the phrase, you know, picture being worth a thousand words, and told you so much about Nintendo games that you never really would have known. So if you're a gamer, it's like, oh my gosh, look at all this cool stuff. You know, it paints a really robust picture you didn't get by just going into the store and looking at the games on the shelves.
Yeah, and it was one of those things where I think if, you know, you wanted to read it, you wanted to be one of the first people to read it because there was going to be information in there that other kids didn't have.
Right, totally.
And so prior to the internet, it was one of those things where it was like almost like bragging rights. So I got the latest Nintendo Power and I know this cheat code you've never seen or this thing you can do, you know, in the back of the wall in this one level. And yeah, kind of amaze your friends for a short period of time.
Yep, that is totally true. And in addition to just being able to, you know, be better at games, it would, you know, tell you about games you had never heard of before, months before they were released. Like you said, there was no internet back then to tell you about all this cool new stuff. So if you saw a game for the first time, there was a very good chance it was because of Nintendo Power.
It's true. I think I learned about a lot of games through Nintendo Power.
Yep, me too, for sure. Of course, in addition to all the strategy coverage, there were posters and previews and, you know, classified information and counselor's corner like you were alluding to. You know, there were even articles on non-gaming things like, you know, TV shows and music and celebrities that nobody cared about. but really, you know, that isn't what Nintendo Power was about. It was about, you know, these huge games. It was about Super Mario Brothers 2 and that Clay Mario on the cover. It was about Zelda 2 and Ninja Gaiden and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and Simon's Quest and, you know, Dracula's Severed Head being on the cover of issue number 2.
How can I forget?
Indeed. So, Pete, how did you get introduced to the magazine? Were you a subscriber all the way from the start?
Well, I was, and before that I was a subscriber of the last issue of the Fun Club newsletter.
Oh, right on.
Yeah, I remember signing up for that thinking like, oh, this is going to be great. And then I got the issue and it came with like a little flyer in it that said, this will be the last issue of this magazine. Mm-hmm. But it also said, but your subscription rolls over to Nintendo Power, or maybe you had to pay. I can't remember.
Well, that first issue was given out free to everybody, but I think that if you wanted to go beyond that, you had to subscribe.
Right. And, you know, Lord knows I didn't pay for it, being 8 years old and all. But I think the first issue proved to me that I was going to need this thing going forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was pretty much in the same situation. It seems that I actually came to Nintendo a little bit after you, because I sent away my card for the Fun Club newsletter, and I didn't get a single issue. I only got this first issue of Nintendo Power, and I still have that original copy I got to this day. And I was, you know, perusing it just a couple of days ago, and I was looking at it. I think I must have even had some sort of second printing or something, because the contest is voided out. It says that it was no longer being accepted. So it already expired by that time. So
wow.
I think maybe by then they'd already started, you know, publishing the second issue, but they were still giving out copies of this first issue to new subscribers.
Hmm.
But yeah, so I got that copy, and then for Christmas that year, I ended up getting a subscription. Me and my brother got a joint subscription to Nintendo Power Magazine.
Yeah, that first issue, I remember reading that Super Mario Brothers 2 piece, like basically beginning to end, just like maybe 100 times. You know, just kind of wanting to know more about the game and wanting to know, you know, it's like... It was a sequel to my favorite game.
Right, right. Same
and
here.
And so I wanted to know everything I could know about it. And it just seemed so weird and such a departure from the first one that, you know, all the information I could learn about it, I was going to become a fanatic over.
Yeah, I mean, you pretty much wanted to know every little detail you could about these games. And so just by staring at these maps and envisioning the routes through the levels and seeing the enemies and the bosses and the power-ups, you know, it was really, really invigorating when you're a kid gamer.
Yeah, it's so bizarre when you think about it now. I can't really imagine being so into it, but it was. I mean, it was so fun. I remember, like, it's almost more fun, and I think it's still true to this day, where the hype of a game is almost more fun than the game itself. It's like, it's fun to speculate, and it's fun to... you know, wonder what this game has in store. And I think there's still something about that process that keeps a lot of people interested in the gaming industry.
Well, I wouldn't say that's more fun than the actual game itself, but yes, there certainly is a huge appeal to that.
Well, I mean, the thing is, a game can come out and be flawed, but when it's in hype mode, it's still in hype mode, and there's really nothing wrong with it.
So I guess I see what you're saying there. But yeah, for me, you know, these early years of the magazine were really what I considered, you know, the golden era of Nintendo Power. And I mean, probably everybody considers that, you know, when they first got into it, you know, the first, you know, couple of years, the first several issues that they were enjoying, you know, to them, that's probably, you know, what was, you know, the magazine's best time, because, you know, it's all new to you and you're really taking all this stuff in. But, you know, there were a lot of classics that were represented in those early years that were really, really great. You know, continuing all of all that good stuff from the first year, the second year had games like Super Mario Brothers 3, DuckTales, Mega Man 2. It introduced the Game Boy and Tetris and Super C. You know, the one thing I didn't like about that second year was that they switched over to the staple-bound issues. And so, you know, I read almost every issue in those first 2 years to death. My first year, those first six issues, you know, they're still in pretty good shape, but issues 7 through 12 are like totally falling apart because of that staple binding.
Yeah, I know. I definitely remember when they did that.
Yeah, it was cool that they had, you know, the 4-page fold-out posters. That was kind of nice. But yeah, those issues, you know, they've really seen better days, at least in my collection. It also allowed them, though, to put in, you know, these like extra guidebooks, these little bound-in guides for Super Mario Brothers 2 and Dragon Warrior. There was an NES game directory. There was a pull-out classified information section. There was a merch catalog that was really nothing more than like a humongous advertising section. But it was cool they were able to do that stuff.
Yeah, totally. I mean, speaking of the poster, my entire room was decorated in those.
Yeah, with the first year issues, I was afraid to take the posters out because I had to, like, you know, tear the magazine or cut it or whatever. But because of the staple-bound issues, those I actually, you know, undid the staples, pulled them out, closed the staples up, and put the posters on the walls. But I fortunately do still have them more or less intact.
Yeah, sadly, I think I scrapped mine.
So what were some of the other highlights for you in those first two golden era years that I was referring to? Was there anything that really stood out to you?
One thing about Nintendo Power that really stood out to me as a kid was that it felt like it was this thing being produced by, like, you know, like 20-year-olds.
Okay.
Like, it felt like it had this, like, low production value. It felt like somebody was, like, inviting you over to their house to, like, check out their games.
Okay.
And I honestly felt like, you know, just from a lot of the imagery you see in the magazine, you know, it's all these, like, kids from the 80s, like, posing with, like, sunglasses on and, like, giving thumbs up.
Some of that. I mean, there was a little bit of lifestyle photography, but really when it came to the visuals, you know, the style that, you know, comes to mind to me was, like, these wonky, crazy graphics with, like, these motion lines, these weird-looking human drawings with big noses. Like, who are these guys supposed to be?
Right.
You know, sometimes there were off-model characters in other game features. Like, instead of using official Mega Man art, they had like some weird wonky Mega Man 2 art that some in-house artist drew instead.
Right. I think I'm referring to some of the like the Counselor Corner photos, or like the
The Counselor Corner photos are classic.
Or like the
mullets everywhere.
Or even just like the ads, like the ad, you know, some of the actual Nintendo Power ads.
Well, they didn't really do ads back then, but yeah, like always, at, you know, like the first opening spread and the last spread. A lot of times that would have some sort of, you know, lifestyle photo of, you know, three guys and a girl all sitting around the telephone on the power line or something, you know?
Right. So it just kind of, I don't know, I think, I don't know if I picked it up back then, but it definitely just felt like you were hanging out at, like, your older brother's house, and it was awesome.
I see. But as far as, you know, covers or features or games from those early years, is there anything that stuck with you?
You know, you mentioned the Castlevania cover, of course, that's will live in infamy forever.
Yes.
The Zelda 2 cover that was kind of creepy, to say the least.
Really? What makes you say that?
I'd like to just know who that was. Who was that person? Who was the model, both Link and Zelda, in that photo?
I think they're both mannequins. I don't think they're real people.
I kind of hope so. Because it's kind of terrifying.
I never noticed before that Link doesn't have his hat in that picture.
Yeah, you're right.
That's kind of the weirdest thing to me now that I'm looking back on it.
Yeah, he's just rocking a mullet.
Yeah.
But other than that, when the official like Super Mario Bros. 3 strategy guide came out.
Oh, yeah.
That was pretty big.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, Pete, because, you know, for the third year of the magazine, you know, they went back to the perfect binding for one thing, and they also, you know, changed the format to be monthly, but not normal monthly. You know, they started doing these strategy guides every other month. So, yeah, starting with issue 13, they had this full issue devoted to being a Super Mario Bros. 3 strategy guide. Then issue 15, I believe, was Ninja Gaiden 2. Issue 17 was Final Fantasy. And then issue 19 was all about four-player games. I'm guessing at that point they ran out of ideas or something, because that seems like such a random choice.
Yeah, considering how many four-player games were on the NES.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was probably a marketing decision. Like, yeah, we really need to sell more four scores and satellites, so, you know, make a issue that's all about this. But then they realized they didn't really have any, you know, great games to anchor it on.
Right.
So it's like, oh, here we go.
When was the Ninja Gaiden issue? Because that was one of my favorite.
The first Ninja Gaiden was issue number 5. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that one has always stood out great to me. And that was a real dude, I'm pretty sure, dressed up as a ninja.
Yeah.
A very white dude dressed up as a ninja.
I'm pretty sure he didn't work at Tecmo or Nintendo.
I don't know. I'm pretty sure that Nintendo has a bunch of ninjas in its employ. That's how they keep a lid on things.
Mm-hmm.
But back to those strategy guides. You know, they were great, I think, if you owned those games, but, you know, less great if you didn't. And, you know, there's a good chance you'd own Super Mario Bros. 3, of course, or maybe even Ninja Gaiden 2 or Final Fantasy. But I did not own Final Fantasy, so that issue for me was like, I've got 100 pages here of nothing I care about.
Wow, Chris, I can't believe you're admitting this now.
Yeah, I was not into RPGs in the 8-bit era. What about you? Did you like the idea of these strategy guides? I mean, obviously you liked the Mario 3 one.
You know, I think for the most part I did. Back then it was like there were certain games that almost everybody owned. And yeah, I guess Final Fantasy is one of those really divisive ones back then, I'm sure. I don't even think I was super into RPGs back then either. But I did like the idea of them, especially like something that you own. It just felt like you were getting this free player's guide. Yeah. For lack of a better way of saying it.
Yeah, well, I mean, that was before they were doing the real player's guides. You know, that still came later, and I think that was, you know, probably the start of that idea, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting to see how that kind of sprouted out from there.
Yeah, and, you know, the magazine did continue to evolve from that point. Like, you know, once the calendar rolled around to 1991, they then switched things up again. It became a regular monthly format. There were no more bi-monthly strategy guides. Instead, it was just, okay, here's your regular Nintendo Power content every month. And, you know, they changed a bunch of other things. They introduced Now Playing, which had these capsulated reviews of pretty much every single game. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they did other design changes. They condensed all the previews into Pack Watch. You know, before that, they had, like, all these different kinds of previews, and I was never sure what the difference was between segments. Like, they had video shorts and Pack Watch and previews. And, you know, because of the lead times of the magazine, I think some of them were supposed to be like, here's games that are out now. Here's games that are coming in the future. But you never really knew when games were coming out back then, so it was kind of, you know, really hit or miss, and end up being very random as to what sections the games ended up being in. But regardless, they did start streamlining the design at that point. And by issue 20, you know, things are looking a little bit neater, a little bit more professional. Of course, the other big thing in 1991 was the introduction of the Super NES. So there was, you know, just a little bit of information in the magazine every month, just a little bit of hype. But for me, it was like huge hype. Like, yeah, you could have just 2 pages or 3 pages or 4 pages, and I would latch onto that, and it got me so super excited.
Yeah, I feel like that was the true purpose of Nintendo Power, really, was to kind of plant that little seed, and then, like, you know, over time you're like just frothing at the mouth for the new console.
Yeah, well, whether that was the, you know, intent or not, that's certainly what it did for me. And it all culminated with issue 28, which was basically the Super NES launch issue. And it featured, you know, maybe you remember this, this big, bold, official Super Mario World art on the cover, you know, Mario on Yoshi. And prior to that, you know, Nintendo Power really hadn't been putting official art on the cover. It was usually, you know, these weird mannequins or clay models or something that really wasn't straight from the game, or maybe it was occasionally custom-made art. But this was, you know, in-your-face official Mario, and it really stood out, and it looked gorgeous, and inside it made the game look completely irresistible. So yeah, it was really doing its job then as a marketing tool and getting me super excited.
That's right. A dynamite adventure takes flight.
Yeah, I mean, just the look of that game, that art, it really sold itself.
Yeah, absolutely.
But getting back to what we were saying earlier about the player's guides, you know, that was also the year where they started introducing some of those cool subscriber bonuses. And, you know, this wasn't the first one, but one that really grabbed me was those original 4 player's guides that you would get for free when you started a new or renewed your subscription to the magazine. So there was this NES Game Atlas that had maps for like all of the major games at the time.
Right.
You know, some of the strategy coverage previously, you know, it would be like, here's the first 80% of the game. But these were the ones that actually showed, you know, that last bit of really important info. Like, oh, here are the final several levels of Super Mario Brothers in addition to the first 7 worlds. You know, here's how to get through, you know, the final palaces in the Zelda games. Here's everything about Castlevania and Mega Man. So, yeah, that was really, really cool. Then they had that Game Boy guide and the Mario Mania guide, which was basically a strategy guide for Super Mario World. And then there was the Super NES guide as well. And to get all of that alongside your subscription for, I think, probably $15, that was just, you know, crazy and mind-blowing.
Yeah, it seemed like a lot of value for sure. Especially when you weren't paying it.
Yeah, totally. But, you know, that reminds me of some of the other, you know, great subscriber bonuses or subscription bonuses that were available throughout the years. What were some of the ones that really were enticing to you?
Yeah, I guess the one that stands out in my mind is the free copy of Dragon Warrior.
Yeah, that is probably the big one.
Yeah, you know, I feel like I probably wouldn't have bought that game otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
But pretty fantastic way to kind of get introduced to a series like that.
Yeah. I mean, I like just renewed when they had that offer, and I guess I could have just extended by a year to get the free game. I don't know why I didn't. I guess because the game didn't really hold that much interest for me.
Again, you didn't like RPGs.
Yeah, exactly. But a bunch of my friends did take advantage of that offer, and so I got to play Dragon Warrior, you know, that way. So in that sense, the free Nintendo Power offer was still allowing me to get introduced to the game and to play the game. But yeah, there were lots of other free offers throughout the year that were really great. Like I said, I was really happy to get those players' guides. Then later on, you know, almost every year, if you wanted to, you know, you renew your subscription, you get a free player's guide. I'm sure I got like my guide for A Link to the Past that way. And then, you know, much, much later on, you know, in the later years of the magazine, you know, there was some really great stuff like the Smash Brothers orchestrated soundtrack, the Twilight Princess soundtrack. And for me, the one that's way better than free copies of Dragon Warrior were free copies of the Zelda Collector's Edition disc for GameCube, which had, you know, 4 Zelda games on it.
That's right. I actually tested that.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Very nice. Yeah, that was always a favorite of mine, of course. Gotta love that Zelda. Anyway, going back to the 90s, in 1992, the magazine got a bit of a redesign again to become even cleaner, and it featured color coding for the games. You know, it had red for NES games, purple for Game Boy, teal for Super NES. That was also when they introduced comics, the Zelda and Mario comics. They changed the top 30 to the top 20 and then were able to include separate lists for all three systems. And of course, that was also the year they introduced George and Rob's Now Playing. Pete, do you remember the 1992 redesign? Is there anything that stood out to you? Did you enjoy George and Rob?
What was the first cover you were seeing on that issue? I'm trying to remember.
The cover to this first redesign issue was Super Castlevania IV, and that was also another personal favorite of mine. I just love the way that the painterly style and the colors all blended together. And of course, you know, Castlevania, one of my favorite series. So yeah, that one's always stood out to me.
Yeah, you know, I definitely do remember this cover. I don't remember Rob and Dave or whoever.
George and Rob, as in George Sinfield, our co-worker.
that George.
Yes. Now, see, here's the thing is that, you know, up until that point, there had never been any personality in Nintendo Power. Mm-hmm. But for some reason, they decided for Now Playing, it's now going to have George and Rob giving their opinions on every game, and that's how reviews will be presented. And, you know, in one way, I would say, oh, this is way before its time. It's great. It's almost like the two of us talking on a podcast. It's just, you know, two guys talking back and forth about games. But, you know, in the context of the magazine, like introducing these two people that you'd never heard of before, even though they'd worked on the magazine for probably quite a long time, it's like, oh, well, who are these guys? What are they talking about? This makes no sense to me. Apparently, it was not very popular with readers, from what I understand.
You know, it's funny, now that I'm looking at the pictures, I definitely do remember this. I just forgot that I worked with him.
Yep, this is the very same George who got to hear me saying strawberry while playing Mario Party.
He didn't like that very much.
No, not so much. But at any rate, you know, no matter what you thought of the magazine in 1992, it was a really great year for games and Nintendo, and I thought the Nintendo Power was really firing on all cylinders at that time. I mean, they had three viable systems to work with. They had lots of great games like Link to the Past, Street Fighter II, Mario Kart, and that momentum carried over for, you know, quite a long time, I would say in the next few years. Over the course of those next few years, some of the highlights included Volume 50 with the gold cover for Link's Awakening and Volume 56 in January 1994, which had this silver embossed Mega Man X cover. Yeah, those were definitely some of the highlights for me.
Ah, do you still have that one?
Oh yeah, I still have the entire collection of Nintendo Power magazine. You better believe it.
Wow, you bet your sweet bippy.
Were there any other highlights for you during that era?
You know, the Play It Loud era was kind of where I think I started to trail off of Nintendo Power.
Well, it wasn't quite Playing It Loud yet. I mean, that came right after this. I mean, it was probably, you know, 1994 or so when they started talking about Project Reality, which was Nintendo Ultra 64. And then they had the Color Game Boys. I mean, I kind of like to associate Play It Loud with the N64, but it was really with these colored Game Boys. Not the Game Boy Color, but, you know, the green, black, yellow, red, clear Game Boy systems. That's what brought out the Play It Loud. And, you know, starting in 1994, but really at the beginning of 95, that's when it all spilled over into the magazine. You know, the January 95 issue even proclaimed Play It Loud on the back cover in a really messy font. And, you know, all that cleaning up they did in the Super NES era, you know, even though this was still the Super NES era, it just went all out the window. It was, you know, these crazy, wacky, outrageous fonts, these colorful background patterns, and, you know, off-center diagonal text, just crazy, wacky, extreme. They were trying to be extreme.
Yep.
You know, lots of rough edges and splatters, and I just got the feeling that Nintendo had decided, you know, people don't think we're cool enough. I mean, you know, they were still winning. They were winning the fight against the Genesis.
Yep.
But Genesis does what Nintendo don't, in case you aren't aware. And, you know, they were kind of the cool kids in town. And then PlayStation was sort of on the doorstep. They were knocking. And I think maybe Nintendo's like, oh, yeah, we have to keep up with them. And so it's really weird because in that era, it was kind of Nintendo being not very Nintendo-y, trying to be edgy and cool instead of just trying to be themselves.
Yep.
So to me, that was really the second era of Nintendo Power in 1995, 1996, when they were really, you know, trying to define a new image for themselves in the pages of NP.
Yeah, and I think that is around the time where I kind of checked out. And I hate to say it like that, but I think they were kind of, they lost their way, and it felt like Nintendo just trying to be edgy for the sake of being edgy.
Well, I don't think it was just for the sake of being edgy. I mean, part of it was, despite the fact that the Super NES had so many great games and is remembered for just having a ton of awesome content, most of it was done in just a couple of years. It felt like, when you read Nintendo Power, the way they're talking about the Project Reality and Ultra 64, that was introduced only a couple years after the Super NES, and they're like talking this up for quite a while. And it seems like they were expecting that to make a big splash much earlier than it was supposed to. And, you read some of these issues in, 94, 95, 96, and sometimes they're like scrambling for coverage. They clearly don't have enough on the Super NES and Game Boy fronts, and they really want to be able to cover Nintendo Ultra 64, as it was called at the time. And I imagine it's kind of like what we were doing as the Wii was dying out. There was like almost a whole year where the Wii was basically dead. We're waiting for Wii U to come out, and we're like, we have almost nothing to write about. What do we do? So, yeah, it seemed like they were really trying to stretch.
Yeah. And I think, the competitors were doing things like allowing, people to write reviews and kind of have a personality. And I feel like Nintendo kind of strayed away from that.
Yeah, I suppose that's true. Nintendo still wasn't doing a whole lot with personality in the pages of the magazine. That wasn't something that changed for, quite a while. But still, despite having some clear difficulties during this time, there were still some really cool things to come out of this era. Epic Center was a great addition, and it probably also helped to fill the pages. They started adding some classic coverage, like they would, start revisiting games that were reissued as Player's Choice titles.
Oh, that's right.
And of course, there were still, a few great games coming out. Donkey Kong Country, Chrono Trigger, Yoshi's Island. 1996 rolled around, and it actually, got a little less messy, and they weren't playing it quite as loud, but it was still pretty extreme. And that's the time that the N64 finally hit, but they couldn't do the kind of coverage they used to do. They couldn't do that emphasis on maps. That was the cool thing when those first issues came out. You could like sort of just look at a map and like, oh, I can see everything the game has to show me, and that really didn't apply when N64 hit.
Right.
So they're really focusing on strategy, but it was, really different from the original Nintendo Power because you couldn't really do the same kind of strategy. There were 3D maps for some games, like Mario 64, obviously, but you really couldn't just look at these maps and be like, okay, I now am totally immersed in this game world. It would sometimes show these top-down maps. Like, I remember these maps that were out there for GoldenEye, and it kind of just looked like some sort of blueprint schematic. I'm like, I have no idea what I'm looking at. I mean, I guess if you were already playing the game, it might make sense,
right.
But for me, who hadn't played it yet at the time, I'm like, this is just utter nonsense. I have no idea what I'm looking at.
Yeah, I think I remember that. It was basically just like a top-down view with like little icons over stuff.
Yeah, that's what a lot of the coverage was like, if they had maps at all. So, yeah, they were clearly trying to cope with this different modern 3D era.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely remember that, and I think during that point, I did not have a subscription, but I would pick up the occasional magazine from the newsstand if there was something that kind of held my interest.
Yeah, I understand. I was still subscribing at that point, but I think once issue 100 rolled around, I think that was about where I cut out for a couple years as well.
Ah, issue 100.
Yep.
What do we have on the cover there?
Oh, that was Mario. I think it was Mario on a gatefold cover, kind of like jumping out of a big issue 100.
That's right.
How can you not have Mario?
Yeah, I definitely remember that issue. That's pretty iconic.
But yeah, in that era, in addition to having these challenges of giving strategy coverage to 3D games, there simply weren't as many games to discuss on the N64 compared to previous years. This was the same time the internet was really emerging to provide competition. And so, yeah, I kind of tuned out for a while myself, I have to admit. This is despite there being some really great stuff at the time. I went back and I did get all the issues I missed. So, like, the gold foil type on the covers that featured Ocarina of Time and Majora's Mask were really great. And, of course, the arrival of Pokemon alone was enough for, readers to still care about the magazine. And that was probably a huge boon. Like, oh, yes, we finally have this great, really popular, fresh series to latch on to. But, yeah, it seemed like for a long time, the magazine was really stuck in a rut. too much strategy, too few games. And man, just look at some of those pages. It is like blurb city. Like every page had like, you know, 36 points of entries, just screenshot, screenshot, blurb, blurb, caption, caption. It was just kind of crazy.
Yeah, almost more like advertising than actual content.
Perhaps. I mean, it was a lot of strategy. So there was value in that, but a lot of times it was for games that, like, no one was going to care about.
Right.
At any rate, it was the Game Boy Advance and Nintendo Power Advance in 2001 that really brought me back. Mm. You know, having this new 2D-focused system really provided the opportunity to reintroduce some of those, you know, classic-style NP layout elements, and, you know, the Game Boy Advance was totally up my alley. I mean, even though I didn't get an N64 for quite a while, you know, I wanted to get a Game Boy Advance right away. I wanted to know everything I possibly could about that system. And so, yes, I was back on board. Of course, by this time, I was already, you know, in the business myself. But still, you know, I wanted to get Nintendo Power. On the other hand, the strategy-heavy coverage, you know, really persisted, you know, all the way for, you know, several more years. But it was sometime during this era, Pete, where you ended up joining Nintendo Power, right? So, you know, I don't know if I've ever heard that story. How did you first become professionally involved with the magazine? Obviously, you were already at Nintendo. You were doing testing and other stuff. How'd you end up working for NP?
Well, that's kind of an odd story. So I started in, 1999 at the very tail end as a game tester.
Uh-huh.
For those that haven't heard, it's literally I was working, you know, 40-hour weeks testing games that hadn't come out yet.
Right.
Which kind of sounds like a dream come true, but sometimes it's really not.
Indeed.
Yeah, and I did that for a couple years, and one day, you know, that department, I was actually a contractor. I wasn't actually a full-time employee for Nintendo. And okay. Being a huge Nintendo fan, that was my dream, was to one day be a full-time Nintendo employee.
Mm-hmm.
So one day, somebody pulled me aside, one of the supervisors, and told me that they weren't going to be hiring anytime soon. And they mentioned that there was another department asking for some help. So I said, yes, sure, I'll take that job. And I didn't even actually know what I was going to be doing.
Sounds like you.
And I went and I actually helped sort of project manage the last series of the NES e-reader games.
Huh.
There was three in that collection. It was like Golf and Donkey Kong 3 and Clue Land.
Oh boy.
And on that project, I met someone named Kim Logan, who was, as you know, the head of design on NP at the time.
Right.
Her and I worked together. She liked me a lot on that project. And she told me that, you know, if anything ever became available on the Nintendo Power staff, that she would definitely let me know. And lo and behold, Chris Shepard, who was the screenshot capturer / production assistant on the magazine at the time,
mm-hmm.
got promoted to writer.
Okay.
And Kim came knocking.
Uh-huh.
And so, yeah, it was one of those things where, yeah, I mean, she told me it was on the magazine. That was a dream come true for me, being, you know, a fan of the magazine all along. And, you know, the main part of my job was to go through and take screenshots for the game. Kind of a win-win for me as far as that goes.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, you know, as you know, Chris Shepard became a writer. He was writing in that role of production assistant. And so, you know, my natural progression was I wanted to do the same. I would love to, you know, write articles for the magazine where possible.
Sure.
Yeah, I was all about it when and if I got the opportunity to do it. And I did on a lot of occasions.
Yes, this is very true. But you are proving, once again, when something sinister happens at Nintendo Power, it's usually Chris Shepard's fault.
Totally.
So what year was this that you officially joined NP?
I think it was 2004.
Okay, all right. Well, it was around 2004 that, you know, finally things were changing at NP. You know, it still had a lot of strategy coverage, but they were also, you know, adding more interviews, more long-form pieces. And then finally, in July 2005, the magazine got its long-awaited, much-necessary redesign.
Mm-hmm. And now, when I started there, that was kind of the thing that was going on.
Oh, okay.
You know, obviously, I was kind of the new guy and didn't really have too much input on it.
Mm-hmm.
But I definitely remember being in a lot of meetings about the redesign.
Yeah, so what kind of thoughts went into the redesign? Is there anything you remember from that period?
Well, they definitely had someone outside Nintendo come in and make recommendations.
Yes, I remember that. I remember hearing about, you know, bringing in some heavy hitters from the magazine design industry to help you guys out.
Yeah, and I think there was a little bit of internal conflict where they didn't think that we necessarily needed somebody to come externally and provide this redesign.
Some of the staffers on the magazine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can see that. Yeah, but at the same time, you know, I think it did allow some creative flexibility. I think there was some like outside perception. You know, sometimes companies, you need like an outside voice to kind of come in and be able to actually make a change, especially to like executives who are buying into this.
Yeah, indeed. And it never hurts to have, you know, additional opinions.
No, and...
Well, usually.
No, and I think I remember one point of contention also was the logo, about how much do we change it and how much do we keep it the same.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that might have been arguably the biggest change of the whole thing. I mean, Nintendo Power hadn't kept its logo the entire time. They did alter it to that, you know, 3D rendered version somewhere along the line.
Yep.
But yeah, it got a completely different logo in July 2005, yeah.
Yeah, and it really was probably the most, you know, identifying trademark of that era. I don't know. It was a very strong icon.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. That's true.
So they didn't want to mess with it too much, but you know, you also want to be able to change it up a little.
Yeah, that's very true. At any rate, you know, the redesign happened, and it ended up, you know, changing fairly significantly. It became a lot more like a traditional magazine in a lot of ways. You know, it still had the letters section, still had Pulse, but introduced a genuine news section, mm-hmm. a preview section. You know, it had, you know, features. You know, some of them were still strategy, some were expanded previews, some of them were just, you know, ridiculous and wacky and wonky. And it, you know, really gave personality to reviews as well. You know, finally they were individual, lengthy reviews with bylines on them and, you know, people able to put their individual stamp on the game rather than everybody being like, you know, writing two words and putting a score on it, which was kind of crazy.
Yeah.
Also introduced the community section with, along with that redesign.
That's right. Ran by our friend Andy Myers.
At first, yes. And then later on by Justin Chang.
Oh, yeah.
But as time progressed, you know, lots of other new things were added. You know, we put in power profiles where we interviewed famous and not so famous game designers. Put in playback to talk about retro games. The short-lived Point and Counterpoint where we got silly graphics of ourselves as we argued about things. News eventually changed into Power Up, where it had not only news, but also the quiz and Warp Zone, where we talked about, you know, things that were in the magazine in the past 5, 10, and 20 years. I had a poll, Star Power with, you know, character profiles, put in the Dodongo dislikes and the Winner Is sections, also add in the Collector's Corner. And of course, you know, once eShops and Wii Channels became a thing, we had the download section. So Pete, you know, out of all that new stuff that was added throughout the redesigned years, the modern era, are there any sections that were particular favorites of yours?
You know, I think the way they did update reviews really did help. Kind of gave it more personality, especially you kind of got to,
yeah, for sure.
You got to know the writers a bit better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, writer's block helped with that too.
Yeah, that's right.
It was just a small thing, but I think it really went a long way in saying like, oh, I can identify with this writer. I can appreciate what he's saying about these games.
Yeah, hopefully they weren't saying that about you, but...
How dare you.
What about you?
Well, obviously, for me, this era was a lot of fun because, you know, the redesign was really what prompted me to come on board. And I know I've talked about this stuff before, so I'm not going to harp on it too much here. But, you know, I love doing the download section, especially once, you know, that was, you know, under my command because I got to, you know, draw attention to all these games that, you know, might slip through the cracks otherwise.
Sure.
I also loved the ability to bring back the manila envelopes in classified information.
That's right.
You know, I never really did that much with community, but I really appreciated what, you know, those guys were able to do and all the cool stories and things they were able to draw attention to there. And then just beyond the sections, you know, I have a special place in my heart for many of the features, including the NES 25th anniversary feature, the 250 Reasons to Love Nintendo feature, you know, the Twilight Princess coverage that I did, and of course, you know, the Cooking with Power article.
Oh, I remember that.
Anything else coming to mind?
Well, shout out to the top 200. I thought that was pretty fun, and I got to put that together.
Oh, yeah. That was you know, right around the time I joined the magazine. I think that already run an installment or two.
Yep, and I remember many an issue where you and I showed up as different pictures throughout the magazine. You know, you trying to hit me over the back with a metal chair.
Ah, yes, that's always a favorite of mine.
I think there was one where I was waiting in line for a Wii.
Yeah, you were definitely photographed a lot for the magazine. I tended to escape it for the most part.
But, I feel like you got in there quite a bit, too.
Yeah, certainly the chopping off the finger with the Cooking with Power article was memorable.
We'll always have the Nintendo Power days, Chris.
Indeed. But really, I think, you know, we have probably gone through all of Nintendo Power's history quite enough. I think that's really enough from us for now. We mentioned in the last couple episodes that we wanted to hear readers' comments about what they loved about NP. So I think I would like to jump into that and read some of their comments.
All right, let's do it.
So this first letter comes from our good friend Joey T, who writes, "After school in junior high, I would stop by the local library and slowly go through their whole NP catalog until I got my own subscription in high school. It's kind of funny because the era I grew up reading, 1996 to 2003, was my introduction, and I now realize that wasn't exactly NP's golden years. I kind of had to dig back. One of my oldest friends and I met because of Nintendo Power. I was on the bus after school, and I noticed two boys got up to leave and were picked on as they passed me. I was new to the area, so I didn't know anyone at all, but I did notice the Nintendo Power with DKC3 on the cover in the hands of my soon-to-be lifelong friend. I went to their aid, and later that afternoon, we were playing Donkey Kong Country and Mega Man X at his house. Fast forward to next year, and I'll be a groomsman in his wedding." Crazy.
Nintendo bringing people together.
Yeah, totally.
This next one is from listener Sam Connor. It says, "I received a year-long Nintendo Power subscription every Christmas of my childhood. My favorite parts were definitely the posters. My walls were covered in them. I eventually ran out of space. I also loved reading the letters in the Pulse section. I wrote in, but never made it into the magazine. I'd like to give you this chance to rethink the score of Monster Hunter Tri on the Wii. 9 out of 10? I assume that was a typo, as that is obviously a 10 out of 10 game. Happy 30th anniversary to Nintendo Power."
Well, Sam, for what it's worth, I wrote into Nintendo Power magazine many times myself, and I never got published in it either until I was working there. As for Monster Hunter Tri, neither of us did that review, and I really haven't played that much of the game, so you'll have to let somebody else be rethinking that score other than us.
Try not to get too angry. Get it?
Try not to. I do get it. This next one comes from listener Brian Booth, who writes, "I really enjoyed coming home on Nintendo Power Day when I was a kid. As time went on and I lost touch with the gaming scene in college, I also stopped following it as much, so I didn't see it go through some of its stylistic evolutions, but after I came back to the light, I picked up a subscription that ran just until a few months before the magazine met its untimely end. The last issue will always hold a special place in my heart. That final strip with Nestor and Maxwell is so evocative of grown-up gamer nostalgia, and as my kids get into gaming themselves, it just becomes more and more resonant. It was the perfect way to say goodbye. I'm not much of a collector, so I'm far from having the full lineup, but issues 50, 75, and 100 are on my shelf along with the New Year's bonus issues from 94, 95, and 96, including the one with an awesome embossed silver Mega Man X cover. I've also got the issues with the Mario Paint, A Link to the Past, Super Mario RPG, and Street Fighter II featured on the covers. My favorite issue, though, is the NES 25th Anniversary issue, volume 260. It's just a great book. The subscriber cover with all those classic NES sprites, hey, it's the Amazon, is wonderful. And page 49, where Sonic creator Yuji Naka talks about the influence of Super Mario Brothers, is one of my favorite parts of any magazine ever. I could go on, but I'll give everyone else some time. Thanks for the memories, guys."
Now, Chris, I'm going to assume that you had something to do with getting the Amazon on the cover.
Probably, but you know, that was probably mostly Chris Slate's doing. I think he was the one who selected the sprites that appeared there. However, I certainly have to agree with them. You know, that was one of my favorite issues, and if I had to pick out a single spread of the magazine to call my favorite, I would probably say it's that page of Super Mario Brothers, where we have not only Yuji Naka but also Hideo Kojima both talking about how much they love Super Mario Brothers. And I know I've said it before, but we spent a lot of time planning that issue, and I think it ended up turning out really well. So that too is one of my favorites. I have to say, Brian definitely has good taste.
Indeed. Well, this next one comes from Twitter at YT Spectre. "I loved getting my subscription back in the day. Sadly, it was for the last year Nintendo Power was made, but at least I got the whole year. I enjoy reading it and looking at Don't Hassle the Hoff, the retrospective on a retro game, and the what we were writing about X years ago. Also, my favorite issues were probably the one about Pokemon Black and White 2 and the Mario and Sonic Olympic Games issue.
Hi, Don't Hassle the Hoff fan. Clearly another man with good taste.
We'll see.
This next one comes from listener Kyle Covino, who writes, easily my most memorable issues of Nintendo Power would be the first ones I ever got. For me, my first issue was number 25 with Battletoads on the cover. I read it so many times growing up that the cover is nearly in tatters. My next one would have to be when I finally started my subscription years later and became a regular reader with issue 73. On the cover was Weapon Lord, which I'm pretty sure almost no one remembers. More importantly, it had coverage of Earthbound, Killer Instinct, and the unveiling of the Nintendo Ultra 64. Definitely a good time to hop on board. And of course, I can't close out my favorite issues without mentioning issue 215. Not only was it a special collector's edition with two different covers, I got the way superior Palkia one, FYI, but also had the infamous Cooking with Power article, which, no joke, is one of my favorite Nintendo Power articles. Sure, it was dopey and goofy, but it was a lot of fun and one of the main reasons I love the magazine. And of course, I still have all these issues handy.
Wow. All right. You guys don't need to be buttering up Hoffman anymore.
Yes. Clearly, also another listener with a very good taste.
Mm-hmm.
This next one comes via Twitter from @mathman1024, who simply writes, my favorite memory was getting a copy of Dragon Warrior for being a new subscriber. What a deal.
What a deal indeed.
Yeah.
This one comes from Twitter @Ganon360. My favorite memory is the issue 17 Final Fantasy guidebook I got signed by Nobuo Uematsu.
Ooh, very nice. Very nice indeed. Another comment, this one comes from @MuzakMize, who writes, issue 114, baby. I pored over the Ocarina screenshots for years till I got my own copy of the game. The first copy of the poster has lasted me since November of 1998 until now as well.
Wow.
Yeah, that's impressive.
That is. This next one comes from Twitter, @Neptune_Walker. Funnily enough, I was a very recent Nintendo Power reader, unlike a lot of other people. I still love that Castlevania Lords of Shadows issue, where you talked about random things from the series' history. It helped me learn a ton about a series I had no experience with and now love. I also remember finding a backlog of 2006 to 2008 issues at a garage sale and discovering a ton of cool games I was missing out on, like Knights for Wii and Metroid Prime 3. A lot of them still had the posters that I've still got up today.
Very cool to hear. That's one of the things that always made us happiest as writers and workers on the magazine, when we're able to introduce people to games they might not have otherwise ever picked up or cared about. So yeah, that is always appreciated.
Yeah, true.
This next one comes from @ToastiestToaster via Twitter, who writes, I really enjoyed issues 250 and 260, as they were really what got me into the rest of Nintendo and not just Pokemon. All the memories being shared in them really got me wanting to experience those games. Also issue 285, as it was just a love letter to the magazine. Hell, even though my first issue was 249, all the stories and memories told in that final issue made me feel nostalgic, even though some were before I was even born. I didn't get Nintendo Power that long, only from issue 249 to the final, but man, it impacted me a lot. Through Nintendo Power, I fell in love with the Zelda series, found the amazing cave story, enjoyed Monster Tail and Ghost Trick, beat my first Mario game, Super Mario Land, on Virtual Console, and developed a love for all things Nintendo. Basically, I'm glad I doubted the existence of Pokemon Heart Gold and Soul Silver enough to want to get information straight from the pros.
Yeah, that's really cool to hear, too. I mean, it's kind of unbelievable somebody joining so late still felt so much impact by the magazine at that point.
Yeah, also nice for him to give a shout-out to Monster Tail and Ghost Trick, two of my personal favorites.
Yeah, Ghost Trick's amazing. This next one comes from @SeriousFan via Twitter. There was this one joke article, I think it was for Cooking Mama, where the writer attempted to recreate dishes from the game and chopped their finger off and left it in the dish.
Yes, that was certainly the highlight of that feature. And the one thing I regret about that, Pete, is that I served my severed finger to Chris Shepherd instead of to you. I really feel like I should have served you that severed finger. It's too bad we can't go back and change that. What a pity.
I fed you my whiskers.
Gross. This next one comes from @EricPlunk via Twitter, who writes, I vividly recall as an 8-year-old picking up volume 28 of Nintendo Power, which featured Mario and Yoshi on the cover and contained a preview for Super Mario World. As I fawned over the new power-ups and crisp 16-bit graphics during the car ride home, I knew what I had to have that Christmas. I can only imagine how many Super NESs were sold as a direct result of exposure to that issue.
Yeah, we were kind of talking about that earlier, but yeah, absolutely. Yeah. The magazine had a huge hand in getting the hype level going.
Yeah, I mean, that was that exact issue I was mentioning earlier. That was really one of my all-time favorites. Yeah, that one really sold the Super NES well.
This next one comes from @SerialQueenLL via Twitter. Oh man, there's a ton of great stuff out there, but one of the most memorable and easiest to discuss in that short segment in the back of 220 that featured all that Earthbound art and a bit about Starman.net. It's how I found a close community that I'm still part of to this day.
That's definitely cool to hear. Yeah, I remember I never had heard about Starman.net until I saw that article as well.
So. Yeah, me too.
This next one comes from @GVBestula via Twitter, who writes, I remember the time I got an NES and a friend called me about a deal I couldn't refuse, the infamous Dragon Warrior Nintendo Power deal. It was a great deal. The game and guide were free, but Nintendo would later top that with their two free Zelda GameCube collection discs. Good times.
Yeah, those were maybe two decades apart, but pretty cool.
Yes, indeed.
This next one comes from @LoveMySNES via Twitter. Before the internet was big, most of the time, NP was the first glimpse of a new game. The Clay Fighter 63 and the third issue always stands out for some reason. I remember being so excited for the game because the Nintendo Power cover looked so cool.
Nice.
Yeah, I definitely remember this one too. Definitely stands out in my mind.
Very cool. This next one comes from @GeekadeChris, who writes, my favorite was the first Mario World screenshots. My imagination went absolutely wild seeing that Bonsai Bill.
This next one comes from @StrawBecky81, and she writes, Nintendo Power's review and coverage of 9 hours, 9 persons, 9 doors made me pick up that game, and it ended up being a life-changing experience. I'm still bummed about not getting the pre-order watch.
Just to be clear, the pre-order watch had nothing to do with Nintendo Power. That was from the fine folks at Axis, I believe. Still, fantastic game, though.
Chris stole half the delivery for himself. Just so you guys know.
Pete is a horrible, filthy liar. This next one comes via Twitter from our friends at @OpPowerUp, and they write, I have plenty of Nintendo Power memories. A lot was simply just seeing that latest issue in the mailbox. I really enjoyed ordering some of the merch from NP's catalog. As for my favorite issue, I'm just going to cop out and say issues 1 to 285 are my favorites. My favorite sections were Pulse and Power Profiles. My favorite article was the Tales of Symphonia article. That alone was enough to convince my brother and me to immediately get the game.
Wow, issues 1 through 285. Well, that's pretty impressive.
That's a lot of favorites, yes indeed.
This next one comes from @CoffeeOlusion via Twitter. And he writes, or they write, I grew up in Ecuador, where American magazine subscriptions were expensive. So in my teens, I pestered a well-to-do gamer friend every month to borrow his copy of the latest Nintendo Power. NP introduced me to Shantae, Skies of Arcadia, and Resident Evil 4, among others.
Very cool. This next one comes from @PCDuoR, who writes, to this day, I still come back to issues 100, 196 to 200, and 285. They're always on hand. I've overanalyzed the lists to death. if it's not clear, all those issues, you know, were like the top 100, the top 200, and the top 285 games of all time lists. So I can understand. That's what that's all about. Yep.
Yeah, I can see that too. This next one comes from @SuperGameJoy via Twitter. And they write, my favorite NP memories include inheriting a huge collection from my neighbor, probably around 50 to 60 issues. One day I got too cool and dumped them all.
Oh no.
So the last few years I've been rebuilding the collection. That huge lot of 90-plus issues cost $50, a steal, included a sealed copy of Melee soundtrack, finally was able to find the old trading card binder at a decent price. Finding opportunities to rebuild the collection has been a blast.
Yeah, it's very unfortunate that he dumped them all, but glad he's able to buy up those issues and rebuild the collection, for sure.
Yeah, pretty cool to know that, you know, if you really wanted to get back into it, it wouldn't cost too much. Plus, the ones that Hoffman are in doesn't really matter anyway.
Pete, one day when you aren't expecting it, you're going to wake up with a beard full of maggots. We have one more very special comment here, and this one comes from former Nintendo Power managing editor, former executive editor, Scott Pelland himself.
Wow.
And he writes, it blows my mind to think that it's been 30 years since Nintendo Power began. I clearly remember discussing the name for the magazine with Gail Tilden and Howard Phillips. I think our first choice was Power Pro Magazine, but the name at that time was owned by a Canadian game retailer, so no go. Who knew that Nintendo Power would become so iconic? I saw a recent post, I think on Kotaku, about an artist who got her start sending an envelope art to NP, which we published. That experience gave her the confidence, or at least was inspiring to her, and she went on to study art, and that's what she does now. I love stories like that. A cynical view of NP would be that the magazine was just a big catalog, but that was never our intention. In fact, Mr. Arakawa, the president of NOA who launched the magazine, believed the magazine's purpose was to help players get the most out of their gaming experience. These days I often run into old-time subscribers, often the parents of my kids' classmates and friends, and just about every one of them remembers how excited they were to get the new issue of Nintendo Power. I think in a lot of ways, Nintendo Power validated their love of video games. It meant that they were part of something bigger than themselves, and that it was okay to be a gamer. Gaming has come an awful long way in those 30 years, and it's fun to think that NP played an important role in that growth.
Aw, that's all warm and fuzzy.
Yeah, I don't think I could have put it any better myself.
You know, it's true. I still, you know, will encounter people from time to time. I tell them I used to work at Nintendo Power, and I think there is still a really special place in a lot of people's hearts for this magazine.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, even 30 years after it began and, you know, 6 years after it stopped being published, it is still very, very beloved. So, yeah, I think Scott put that very, very well. I had no idea, though, that Power Pros was considered for the magazine name, however. I recall hearing that Power Players was a choice, but never knew about Power Pro. I guess the name of this podcast is even better fit than we thought. Anyway, thanks to Scott for his contribution, and thanks to everybody else who wrote in to help us celebrate this 30th anniversary occasion.
Hear, hear.
Yeah, I don't think we have really anything else to add at this point, so I do believe it is time to wrap up this episode of the podcast.
Oh, we're done?
Well, not entirely. I believe we do have time for one more thing, and that would be, of course, a dramatic reading.
All right. Well, since this is a special episode, it better be a good one.
Oh, it is indeed. This is, from the pages of Nintendo Power Magazine, the original preview of the Power Glove. Move over, Michael Jackson. This glove will make you a video superstar. Called the Power Glove, this controller by Mattel should be out by Christmas. It works when you move your hand in front of the screen, flexing your fingers, or by pressing the control buttons on your wrist. It's super high tech, like something out of a sci-fi movie. Technically, it works with ultrasound. The demo games include a handball game, Looked Easy, and a Tank Commander game. The hand on the screen followed every move you made, flipping switches, pressing buttons, firing the cannon. Mattel says it should be under $90. This is amazing. Part player, part machine, you've got it all.
Wow. If that's not an advertisement, I don't know what is.
I noticed that they mentioned it works a couple of times in that copy, and really, work should probably be in quotes. You know, works and power glove are words that really don't go together very, very well.
Now, it's funny because it sounds like it's definitely written from the perspective of somebody who's never used it.
Well, you know, this was after it debuted at CES. They'd seen it for the first time, and, you know, like you were kind of saying earlier, when a game or a product first debuts, you don't really know if it's going to be crap until later. So,
right.
You know, that's kind of the way it unfolds sometimes. Often you're optimistic at first, you know?
Yeah, now I'd be willing to bet almost $1,000 that either Scott or George wrote that.
It's very possible, but you'll have to take that up with them. Anyway, this episode has gone on very, very long, so it is time to wrap it up for this week. As always, you can find us at powerpros.podbean.com, and you can follow us at powerprospod on both Facebook and Twitter. You can follow me, The Hoff, on Twitter at Chris The Hoff, and you can find Pete at Burly Red Yeti. You can email us at powerprospod@gmail.com, and if you like the podcast, it would be great if you told your friends about us. Thanks for listening, everybody. For myself, Pete Michaud,
the source for Nintendo straight from the pros,
and our good friend, the WVBA champion, Little Mac.
Pizza cake!
We will see you next time.